anecdotes, religious, moral, and entertaining, alphabetically arranged and interspersed with a variety of useful observations. By Charles Buck. Preface. The Reverend Charles Buck was a dissenting minister of South Britain who died a few years since. A man of considerable erudition, of an inquisitive and discriminating mind, and of fervent piety. His most elaborate work was his theological dictionary, which has passed through several editions and is still held in high and just esteem. Besides this, he published several volumes of miscellanies, all of which have a considerable degree of merit and have had a pretty extensive circulation. But of all his works, that which is here offered to the public and which forms a part of his miscellanies blends the useful with the pleasant in the greatest degree. Of his anecdotes, religious, moral, and entertaining, alphabetically arranged and interspersed with a variety of useful observations, I hesitate not to say that I know of no work which more happily unites instruction with entertainment. It requires no effort of the mind to be understood, and can weary no one by a long demand of attention to a particular subject. It cannot be read without interest, and it is, in every part, calculated to leave an impression on the mind favorable to virtue, piety, or benevolence. It instructs by example. It can be taken up at a leisure moment and laid down at pleasure without leaving a subject unfinished. All who read serious books at all, I am ready to suppose, would like to have in their possession such a book as this. It is a book of amusement for the scholar and of profitable instruction to those who read but little. The character given of it when first published in the Evangelical Review was as follows, quote, "This work is well calculated for young persons and may prove in many cases a very acceptable present to them, as it conveys much instruction mingled with entertainment. It will also serve for a pleasing companion to the traveler in the chaise or the stagecoach. In short, it affords a copious fund of rational amusement for a leisure hour. We have no doubt but it will obtain, as it certainly merits, an extensive circulation." End quote. Ashbel Green, Philadelphia, August 3rd, 1831. Author's Preface. To inform the mind, affect the heart, and promote the best interests of mankind must ever be considered as a pleasing and honorable employ. Various means, indeed, may be made use of in order to accomplish these ends. Some do good by wise and judicious conversation, others by constant and laborious teaching, and many by an excellent and uniform character. The compiler of these volumes has here attempted to contribute something towards so good and desirable a work. It need not be observed that men are naturally indifferent about their duty to God, and unconcerned as to the welfare of their immortal souls. Any attempt, therefore, to set before them the grand object of veneration and worship, to rouse them to duty, to facilitate their happiness, to show them the deformity of vice, and to inspire them with true and exalted views of the sacred religion of Jesus, cannot, I think, be considered as unworthy of attention. How far this work will conduce to these ends must be left to the judgment of the reader. Volumes of anecdotes have already been presented to the public under various titles, but none that I know of which have been more particularly selected as religious and more immediately calculated to lead men to genuine devotion and solid piety. It is to be lamented that while many write merely to amuse the imagination, the real profit of the mind is not thought of. The passions, perhaps, are affected, and the fancy pleased, while the temper remains unsubdued, the heart unimpressed, and the conduct unstable and irregular. Now, without incurring the charge of egotism, I hope the present work, while it affords a degree of entertainment to the reader, will also tend to excite reverence for the best of beings, a regard for the noble and delightful system of Christianity, together with benevolence to our fellow mortals, and an earnest desire to devote ourselves to the glory and service of our God and Savior. The reader will eventually see that novelty has not been so much my design as utility. If any object, however, to the work on this account, I can only say in reply that anecdotes cannot be made. In writing on any system, invention may be displayed and the ideas of the author may bear the air of novelty. But in a work of this kind, we must confine ourselves to our materials. I own it is not difficult to find, now and then, an original anecdote. But in this age of writing and publishing, it would be very difficult indeed to find a volume of them, since almost everything of importance is speedily conveyed to the press for the public benefit. We must therefore take them as we find them, and make the best improvement of them as we can. I am conscious that every anecdote will not strike the mind of the reader with equal importance, nor can it be expected that in a selection of some hundreds it should be so. Besides, men are of different tastes. They form different views and are situated in different circumstances. Each one, therefore, will judge favorably of that which is most congenial to his own ideas. The compiler, however, deprecates the severity of the critic and hopes that candor will perform the office of a kind friend who is more disposed to pardon than to indulge a spirit of invective. In respect to authenticity, which is of considerable importance in a work of this kind, I have carefully avoided what appeared to be apocryphal and bore but scrupulous evidence. Yet, after all, if anything should be found of this kind, which I am ignorant of, if there be, still its moral or use will be found beneficial, pointing the reader to view religion and morality as worthy of his sincere regard and constant pursuit. To conclude, if any good be done, any mind instructed, any comfort derived, if love to men, gratitude to our adorable Redeemer, any firm adherence to the truth be excited or promoted by this selection, it will abundantly compensate the little labor and feeble efforts of the compiler. Charles Buck. Anecdotes. Afflictions. Whoever considers the manifold calamities to which mankind are exposed in the present state must feel some emotion of sorrow. Sin has introduced great misery and universal disorder into the world. No person, however mean and obscure, or eminent and exalted, can stand invulnerable against the arrows of adversity. It is, however, the peculiar privilege of a good man that, though, alike with others, he partakes of the sufferings of humanity, yet he sees a wise hand directing every event, and rendering all subservient to a grand and glorious end. He desires to learn the noble lessons of patience and submission, while his heart glows with gratitude to Him to whom he is indebted for every comfort he enjoys, and without whose permission he knows no evil can transpire. Ebenezer Adams, a celebrated Quaker of Philadelphia, on visiting a lady of rank, whom he found 6 months after the death of her husband sitting on a sofa covered with black cloth, and in all the dignity of woe, approached her with great solemnity, and, gently taking her by the hand, thus accosted her, "So, friend, I see that thou hast not yet forgiven God Almighty." This seasonable reproof had such an effect upon the person to whom it was addressed that she immediately had all her trappings of grief destroyed, and went about her necessary business and avocations. A word spoken in due season, how good is it! Afflictions, though not blessings in themselves, yet when sanctified are productive of great good to them who are exercised thereby. Even Demetrius, a heathen, could say, quote, that nothing could be more unhappy than a man who had never known affliction, end quote. And one who was not a heathen has left it on record that it was good for him to be afflicted. Let us not therefore sink into despondency under a view of approaching difficulties, nor suffer our imaginations to dwell with horror on supposed future events. Quote, the evils and afflictions of this life indeed appear like rocks and precipices, rugged and barren at a distance. But at our nearer approach, we shall find little fruitful spots and refreshing springs mixed with the harshness and deformities of nature. End quote. A minister was recovering of a dangerous illness when one of his friends addressed him thus, Sir, though God seems to be bringing you up from the gates of death, yet it will be a long time before you will sufficiently retrieve your strength and regain vigor enough of mind to preach as usual. The good man answered, You are mistaken, my friend, for this 6 weeks' illness has taught me more divinity than all my past studies and all my 10 years' ministry put together. It is related of one who, under great severity, had fled from the worst of masters to the best. I mean, he had sought rest in the bosom of Jesus Christ, the common friend of the weary and the heavy laden, that he was so impressed with a sense of the benefit he had derived from his afflictions, that lying on his deathbed and seeing his master stand by, he eagerly caught the hands of his oppressor and, kissing them, said, These hands have brought me to heaven. Thus many have had reason to bless God for afflictions, as being the instruments in his hand of promoting the welfare of their immortal souls. It is said of Dr. W. that from his most early infancy to his dying day, he scarcely ever knew what health was. Yet we are told that he looked upon this affliction as the greatest blessing of his life. And the reason he assigned for it was that, being naturally of a warm temper and an ambitious disposition, these visitations of divine providence weaned his affections from the world and brought every passion into subjection to the divine will.
Avarice. Of all characters, perhaps, none are so truly wretched as the miser. The prodigal, it is true, spends his substance, but then he attempts to enjoy himself and to make others happy around him, whereas the covetous man does neither. Avarice is a principle not only detestable in its nature, but prejudicial to the possessor of it. Inasmuch as it alienates the mind from God, frequently leads to dishonesty among men, and, what is worse, is a disorder hardly ever cured. Quote, Other passions have their holidays, but avarice never suffers its votaries to rest. End quote. Quote, O cursed lust of gold, when for thy sake the fool throws up his interest in both worlds, first starved in this, then damned in that to come. End quote. Blair. Quote, Joshua, says Ambrose, could stop the course of the sun, but all his power could not stop the course of avarice. The sun stood still, but avarice went on. Joshua obtained a victory when the sun stood still, but when avarice was at work, Joshua was defeated. End quote. In December 1790, died at Paris, literally of want, Mr. Osterwald, a well-known banker. This man felt the violence of the disease of avarice, for surely it is rather a disease than a passion of the mind, so strongly that within a few days of his death, no importunities could induce him to buy a few pounds of meat for the purpose of making a little soup for him. 'Tis true, said he, I should not dislike the soup, but I have no appetite for the meat. What then is to become of that? at the time that he refused this nourishment for fear of being obliged to give away 2 or 3 pounds of meat, there was tied round his neck a silken bag which contained 800 assignats of 1,000 livres each. At his outset in life, he drank a pint of beer, which served him for supper, every night at a house much frequented, from which he carried home all the bottle corks he could come at. Of these, in the course of 8 years, he had collected as many as sold for 12 louis d'ors, a sum that laid the foundation of his future fortune, the superstructure of which was rapidly raised by his uncommon success in stock-jobbing. He died possessed of 120,000 pounds sterling. There have been few persons in whom avarice has predominated more than in the late Mr. Elwes. His mother, indeed, was excessively avaricious, and though she was left nearly 100,000 pounds by her husband, yet she absolutely starved herself to death. Mr. Elwes seemed not less wretched than his mother. At his house at Stoke in Suffolk, if a window were broken, it was mended by a piece of brown paper or by patching it with a small bit of glass, and this had been done so frequently and in so many shapes that it would have puzzled a mathematician to say what figure they represented. To save fire, he would walk about the remains of an old greenhouse or sit with a servant in the kitchen. In the advance of the season, his morning employment was to pick up chips, bones, or anything he could find, and carry them home in his pocket for fire. One day he was surprised by a neighboring gentleman in the act of pulling down, with great difficulty, a crow's nest for this purpose. And when the gentleman wondered why he should give himself so much trouble, "Oh, sir," replied Elwes, "it is really a shame that these creatures should do so. Do but see what waste they make. They don't care how extravagant they are." He would almost eat anything to save expense. At a time when he was worth 800,000 pounds, he would eat game at the last state of putrefaction, and meat that no other person could touch. As to his dress, anything would do. He wore a wig for a fortnight, which he picked up in a rut in the lane when riding with another gentleman. His shoes he never suffered to be cleaned, lest they should be worn out the sooner. As the infirmities of old age, however, came upon him, he began to be more wretched. It is said that he was heard frequently at midnight, as if struggling with someone in his chamber, and crying out, "I will keep my money! Nobody shall rob me of my property." There are many other remarkable circumstances related of him, but what we have already quoted afford a striking proof of the vanity of sublunary things, and of the insufficiency of riches to render mankind happy. See his life. Daniel Dancer, Esquire, was remarkable for a miserly disposition. Lady Tempest was the only person who had the least influence on this unfortunate man. She had one day the pleasure of prevailing on him to purchase a hat, having worn his own for 13 years, from a Jew for a shilling. But to her great surprise, when she called the next day, she saw the old chapeau still covered his head. On inquiry, it was found that, after much solicitation, he had prevailed on old Griffiths, his servant, to purchase the hat for 18 pence, which Mr. Dancer bought the day before for a shilling. He generally, in severe weather, laid in bed to keep himself warm. To light a fire he thought expensive, though he had 3,000 pounds per annum, besides immense riches. He never took snuff, for that was extravagant, but he always carried a snuff-box. This probably he would fill in the course of a month by pinches obtained from others. When the box was full, he would barter the contents for a farthing candle at a neighboring greengrocer's. This candle was made to last till the box was again full, as he never suffered any light in his house except while he was going to bed. He seldom washed his face and hands but when the sun shone forth. Then he would betake himself to a neighboring pool and used sand instead of soap. When he was washed, he would lie on his back and dry himself in the sun, as he never used a towel, for that would wear, and when dirty, the washing was expensive. Since his death, there have been jugs of dollars and shillings found in the stable. At the dead of night, he has been known to go to this place, but for what purpose even old Griffiths could not tell, but it now appears he used to rob one jug to add to the other. Monseigneur Vendil was the most remarkable man in Paris, both on account of his immense riches and his extreme avarice. He lodged as high up as the roof would admit him, to avoid noise or visits, maintained one poor old woman to attend him in his garret, and allowed her only 7 sous per week, or a halfpenny per day. His usual diet was bread and milk, and by way of indulgence some poor sour wine on a Sunday. This prudent economist had been a magistrate or officer at Boulogne, from which obscurity he was promoted to Paris, for the reputation of his wealth, which he lent upon undeniable security to the public funds, not caring to trust individuals with what constituted all his happiness. While a magistrate at Boulogne, he maintained himself by taking upon him to be milk taster general at the market, and from one to another filled his belly and washed down his bread without expense to himself. When he was become exceedingly rich, he one day heard a woodman go by in summer, at which season they stocked themselves with fuel for the winter. He agreed with him at the lowest rate possible and stole from the poor man several logs, with which he loaded himself to his secret hiding hole and thus contracted, in that hot season, a fever. He then sent for the first time for a surgeon to bleed him, who, asking half a livre for the operation, was dismissed. He then sent for an apothecary, but he was as high in his demand. He next sent for a poor barber, who undertook to open a vein for 3 pence a time. But understanding from the barber that he should be blooded 3 times, he asked what quantity of blood it was meant to take at once. "About 8 ounces each time," answered the barber. "That will be 9 pence. Too much," says the old miser. "I have determined to go a cheaper way to work. Take at once the whole quantity you designed to take at 3 times, and that will save me 6 pence. Which being insisted on, he lost 24 ounces of blood and died in a few days, leaving all his vast treasure to the king, whom he made his sole heir. Thus he contracted his disorder by pilfering, and his death by an unprecedented piece of parsimony." This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit my blog, westportexperiment.com, where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.